Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Inflation is making back-to-school shopping much more of a burden this year.
This bonding experience has just been hammered. Parents, they're just weary. They're worn out. They've gone through 2 years of COVID, and now they're getting socked by inflation.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida examines how much more families are spending to get kids their school gear. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear about the recruiting challenges the U.S. military is facing these days. Arts Playlist highlights the latest round of state funding for the arts. And Enlighten Me takes us to another historic building threatened by demolition by neglect. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. August is here, and for many families, that means getting kids the gear they need for school this fall. And this year, back-to-school shopping comes with a new set of challenges as inflation leaves many trying to figure out how to pay for everything they need. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a closer look at the back-to-school shopping landscape in her latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she learned. So let's start where we usually start, which is what are retailers expecting from back-to-school sales this year compared to recent years? Do they see, despite inflation, a good year?
I think that they are, well, we know that parents are going to be spending more, but they're not going to be getting more for their money. The inflation looms large. According to a poll by Deloitte, we're going to be spending about 8% more per kid. And that is about $661 up from, but that is up 27% from 2019, the last back to school season before COVID closed a lot of schools. And the National Retail Federation, and it's a huge, the biggest retail group, says that shoppers are going to spend about $37 billion with a B this year on back to school shopping, and that will match last year's record season, even with people economizing, and that is about $864 a pop.
Wow! So the money's still flowing into retailers. What's coming out to families, though, is not, as you said, as much. And the main factor, obviously, is inflation. We saw some increased costs last year because there were supply chain issues at this time of the year. But this year, as you've made clear, it seems so much worse. What's the biggest impact? Are there items that are just simply much more costly this year that families just have to bite the bullet and buy, even though the sticker price is like, oh, boy?
Yeah, I mean, the big three that we see the largest increases in are computers, electronics, and furnishings for dorms. You know, your kid's microwave, that little fridge, linens, things like that. And just staples are going to be paying more money for backpacks and lunchboxes. But the increase is not as great as for the big three, the computers, electronics, and door furnishings.
And you also note in your piece that the high costs are prompting more people to turn to credit cards to get everything they need, correct? This is not, you know, a situation where maybe you have that money just hanging around to spend on these things.
Well, most parents had that money hanging around last year. Because there was a lot of money that was going out that was because of the pandemic and because of the child tax enhancement, but those things have gone away. So it's been tough for parents who had kind of gotten used to getting that extra money, and now it's not coming in, and so they're having a hard time with their budgets. So almost half, 42% of parents are expected to take on some level of debt to pay for school shopping.
And I guess there's, you know, one strategy you can use to deal with these high prices and maybe lower the costs is, you know, things like thrifting, shopping secondhand. Are we seeing more of that? Can that really help drive your final costs down if you go in that direction?
You know, we are, and it truly is a win-win. There are plenty of gently used things out there, particularly in clothing, that are perfectly good, that some other kid can wear to school and get good use out of, and it doesn't wind up in the landfill or whatever. It's a really good strategy. And Goodwill stores in Delaware have really gotten with the program. They have back to school shopping sections, and a lot of them have racks that are dedicated just to school uniforms. So if you're looking for that deal, that is one portion of your budget that consumers do have some control over, that they can go out there and shop and get a good deal.
It might take a little more legwork, but in the end, it might be worth it to do so. Are there any bigger sales or deals out there that could also help people lower their back to school costs?
There sure are. I mean, Walmart is always the leader in deals. And this year you can get a 24-pack of crayons for 50 cents, a 70-page notebook for 35 cents. Another doorbuster is a 4-pack of Sharpie highlighters for $2.77. Target is really helping parents out with deals on backpacks and shoes. And Target and Bed Bath & Beyond are, in addition to offering discounts to teachers, are also offering discounts to college students.
Any benefit to shopping online versus heading out to a store at this point?
Well, you don't have to put gas in your car. The back to school has traditionally been hands-on. It's been a really good experience for parents and kids to go out and enjoy themselves. They can comparison shop. They can get their own little lesson in home economics. They can, have ice cream, do something together. Just from the folks that I'm talking with, we are seeing a lot less joy in back to school shopping. Which, as somebody who's covered retail for 25 years, this really I think is very significant, that this bonding experience has just been hammered by parents. People, they're just weary. They're worn out. They've gone through 2 years of COVID, and now they're getting socked by inflation, and they're tired.
And I suppose all this doom and gloom is one reason why I think you're reporting that people are just putting off shopping to begin with. Are people kind of procrastinating, maybe just because they just don't want to deal with it?
Yeah. Traditionally, back-to-school promotions start around the 4th of July. And they have been pushed back this year. And I think that a part of that is because uncertainty has become the norm. And people don't feel a great sense of urgency to plan ahead because they've internalized that things change. And things change rapidly. And that's reflected in the way schools are conducting business because they've had to change too. And a number of districts throughout the state of Delaware haven't even put out their list of supplies yet.
And finally, we usually talk about back-to-school shopping being a bit of a harbinger of what to expect for the next big shopping season, which, of course, is the holiday shopping season. Are retailers keeping a close eye on what we're seeing here, the trends that are forming to get a sense of how good or bad things may be in a few months?
I think so. How can they not? It's these two seasons, they are the two most important seasons for retailers. And if people aren't feeling great, if people aren't feeling confident about back to school shopping, you don't have a lot of time to turn that ship around before the next couple of few months when we get into the winter holiday shopping season. So I'm hoping that that there are some sort of events that restore consumer confidence, because I think that's what's needed. And if not, it might just be a tough holiday season following a tough back to school shopping season.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media contributor Eileen Dalabrida. You can read Eileen's piece on back to school shopping right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The U.S. military faces some real recruiting challenges these days. We take a look at what's fueling those challenges and how it's playing out here in Delaware. Next, this is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The U.S. military faces what's described as the worst recruiting environment since the all-volunteer force was established in 1973. A number of factors are plaguing recruitment efforts, and military leadership is looking at long- and short-term strategies to reverse a downward spiral caused by the pandemic, an unstable economy, and a shrinking pool of eligible candidates. For a broader look at the military's recruitment shortfall, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry spoke with senior reporter for the Army Times, Davis Winky.
The U.S. Army reported in June it hit just 40% of its recruiting goal for the fiscal year, which ends in September. When did this start to become a problem?
Army officials have been dealing with challenging recruiting waters for a few years now. You know, the COVID pandemic took recruiters out of the places where they traditionally find people, mass events like malls, sports games, you know, visits to high school sports games, you know, the kinds of things that really drove recruitment for the Army just ground to a halt. But both in 2020 and fiscal 2021, they managed to make do and hit their targets. And they predicated this year around thinking that the recruiting environment would return to normal, so to speak. But around 6-7 months ago, they saw the early numbers come in for the fiscal year and realized that that was just not going to be the case, that something else was going on.
Now, the Army's being hit the hardest. And what do we know about why that is?
Well, it's tough to say. While all the branches of the military have acknowledged that this has been a uniquely challenging recruiting environment, because on top of the pandemic stuff, you've got an economy that's at full employment, even if we're starting to see some cracks in the economic picture, you know, and we're seeing ongoing long-term trends like a decrease in young Americans who are qualified to join because of things like rising childhood obesity. You see things like weed being legalized around the country, but you still can't if you want to join the military. You know, like, you've got this other backdrop, and the other services have said this is really challenging, but they each have an identity that young Americans, your Gen Z kids, can latch onto. For the Air Force, it's you're involved with these worldwide air bases, able to fly missions and stuff. With the Navy, it's, you know, Top Gun and boats. With the Marine Corps, it's, you know, kind of your friendly neighborhood cult with people who grunt at each other and wear really good-looking classic dress uniforms. But with the Army, what is the service's identity when it comes to the way it's trying to sell itself to Generation Z? You know, the Army is the biggest of the services. It has the most diverse capabilities, everything from sea lift to almost all the helicopters in the military to your ground and pound infantrymen. There's just not this coherent identity, these coherent vibes, so to speak, that they can really trade on with the current generation. And that might be part of why they're struggling worse than the other services.
How are the other branches of the military doing when it comes to meeting their goal for recruits?
So when it comes to the Marine Corps, the Air Force, the Space Force, they've met their enlisted recruitment goals. They've had their personnel chiefs say publicly that they still had, you know, really challenging time doing it, but they're on track to meet it. We're likely to see something of a shortfall from the Navy, but not to the extent that the Army is going to experience. But again, when it comes down to it, the Army has to recruit the most people out of all the services, and they have to do it for the widest array of jobs, which require, you know, different kinds of eligibility factors like security clearance eligibility, test scores, in some cases, educational experience. The Army just has a more complex task in front of it than the other services, and it's just not getting it done right now.
What initiatives are underway to try to boost recruitment? I know you've gone over some. Are there any kind of specific goals here that they're trying to incentivize for recruits?
So early on in the fiscal year, the Army pulled all the levers it usually does when it sees the warning signs that recruiting might be tough. Things like increasing bonuses, things like increasing under the table, increasing more things like drug waivers and stuff, like advertising to people like, hey, you know, we might be looking willing to look past a little more of your history if necessary, if you can otherwise show that you should be in. Things like letting recruits choose their first duty station, you know, take shorter contract lengths, get bonuses for shipping to training within 45 days of signing up. These are things that in the past have traditionally been able to help the Army buoy its recruiting numbers when it needs to. They're not working this time. And so a lot of other things are on the table. Among them is there is a Defense Department-wide review of medical accession standards to see if the current medical standards for letting people in should be the way that they are. You know, right now, if you've been prescribed an inhaler after the age of 13, you're medically disqualified from joining the military. Those are the kinds of things that they may be taking a hard look at and saying, like, to sustain a modern day force, do we need to edit these standards? And then on the other end, the Army has been on the leading edge among the other services to try to get ahead of one of the other factors affecting the applicant pool, which is the obesity epidemic. The Army recently established what's called the Future Soldier Prep Course at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, where they're doing a pilot program where they're going to let recruits sign up with a preliminary contract with up to 6% more body fat than is usually authorized to join the military with. They're also doing a similar prep camp for prospective troops with lower test scores. And they're signing them up, sending them to Fort Jackson and saying, hey, you have 90 days to either, you know, lose body fat or to improve your test scores based off whatever it is you need. And they're leaning on programs that they've used in the past for people who are already in the service that they think they have data to support working. And they're trying to see if they can invest and meet society halfway, because the Army's gambling that these societal trends towards lower test scores and greater obesity rates may not change in the long term. So they're going ahead and figuring out, okay, how can we make the most of this and help young Americans meet our standards before they are then allowed to move on to their basic training unit?
What do we know about how the public's perceptions of the military, how that factors into this dilemma?
The military is honestly facing what could be a crisis of public trust. Part of this has to do with relentless politicization of the military over the past few years. Whether it's from the way that Mark Milley walking with Donald Trump through Lafayette Square in June 2020, but, you know, the fallout from that, or the way that the Defense Department has mandated the COVID-19 vaccine and the way that the vaccine has also been heavily politicized.
Thanks to Army Times reporter Davis Winky for joining us this week to talk about the military's ongoing recruitment shortfall. So how's what we just heard playing out here in Delaware? And how are recruiters here responding? Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry also took some time this week to talk with Sergeant Major Pablo Cortez with Delaware National Guard Recruiting to get a view of things on the ground here.
What are you experiencing with recruitment right now? Are you meeting goals and standards?
No, we're not meeting goals and standards. Recruiting's been tough. Recruiting was pretty good prior to COVID. And after COVID, you know, the access to our target market was limited. We did a lot via Zoom, but the, you know, our target market is mostly high schoolers and college here in the state of Delaware. And that was severely, obviously, was blocked, you know, with COVID. This year, you know, we started getting back to what was considered, you know, the norm, even though there's no more old norm, there's a new norm. And we're starting to get access back to the schools, to the, our target population. It's, we're on the upward, you know, trajectory, but it was tough. It was tough just trying to get in front of them and even the school administrators too, because we were unable to have the face-to-face. So the lack of a face-to-face opportunity really hurt.
What changes has the state National Guard had to make when it comes to recruiting?
We try to be creative. You know, we tried to host Instagram lives with recruiters where we do Q&As. We did Zoom briefings to school administrators describing the Army National Guard and what we do. And then the other thing we did was we just pretty much put a spotlight on what we did for COVID. So if anything that this pandemic did, it just highlighted what we do as a organization, being out in the community. So during COVID, we supported vaccine sites, testing sites. We had a CNA mission. We had a hospital mission. So we were at the forefront of working with first responders and medical personnel. So if anything, it highlighted just what it is that we do on a part-time basis, but it became a full-time basis because obviously the pandemic required that support.
Of the recruits you do sign, what do they give as their main reason or motivation for joining the military? And also, what concerns do potential recruits or their parents express about joining the military?
The majority of our enlistments are because they have a need. Now, one of our main incentives here is we pay 100% tuition for Delaware State, University of Delaware, and Delaware Tech. So we're another avenue for someone to get their education. We're also an avenue for someone to learn a trade. Sometimes applicants have a history of serving, of their family serving in the military. But we're most of the time, it's a need. It's a need to continue education. It's a need to learn a skill set, or it's a need to serve. But it's all based on what that need is for that individual and their family. But the main thing is the incentives, you know, to continue your education.
And what about ROTC programs in local schools and Delaware Military Academy? What are we seeing there?
So we're select high schools have ROTCs, and then as well as the colleges. So we try our best, you know, to make a partnership with these ROTCs. One of the things that we do is for high school junior ROTCs is we host this event called the Minuteman Challenge, where we bring all the ROTCs into one location and we do physical activities and things like that. And we award the winners of the overall challenge. With the college ROTCs, we support with helping with physical fitness. We support by doing classes with them, or if they have a specific type of training that we can help out with, whether it's providing transportation, if it's providing weapons for them to qualify, or just a need for some instructors on a specific topic, we support that as well. So we have pretty good relationships with these junior ROTCs and their ROTCs in college.
Thanks to Sergeant Major Pablo Cortez with Delaware National Guard Recruiting, Army Times reporter Davis Winky, and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist and more on the Delaware Division of the Arts' latest round of arts funding. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Division of the Arts recently announced its first round of grants to support arts projects statewide in fiscal year 2023. The agency is investing almost $3 million in more than 110 arts and community organizations that provide everything from arts programming and services to arts education, marketing, and promotion. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Division of the Arts Director Jessica Ball joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss this latest round of funding.
We're really, really excited to announce, the $3 million that is going out in our annual grants. This is our biggest tranche of money for the year. And as you mentioned, it goes out to support several of our grant programs, including our general operating support grant, project support, which is really for community-based organizations that provide arts programming. We have our art stabilization grant category that supports capital improvement projects. We have our startup category, which is for emerging arts organizations. And then we also have our education-based grants that you mentioned. So these are our big annual grants. The division has several other grants that we grant out throughout the year that are on rolling deadlines. But this is certainly our biggest investment of the year.
All right. You have been quoted as saying, and this is a direct quote, artists and arts organizations statewide have been on the cutting edge of the innovation and community impact over the last 2 years as they turn to a new phase of recovery from the shutdowns related to Delaware's public health emergency. You said it's critical that the Delaware Division of the Arts continue our significant investment into the sector. Expand on that for me.
Sure. I think we all know by now that the arts and culture sector, the creative economy as a whole, was one of the disproportionately impacted sectors in our economy during the pandemic. Many of our organizations were shuttered initially, and then, of course, spent time coming up with new ways to deliver arts and creativity to Delawareans. And so as we're coming out of the pandemic, it's really important that we invest in these organizations so that they're able to thrive and deliver the type of arts programming that Delawareans need. I mean, it became really evident during the pandemic how essential arts are to our lives and to helping to maintain our mental health. It became evident how damaging and disruptive isolation can be. And I think the arts are a way to really bring communities together post-pandemic. So we want to set these organizations up in a position of strength so that they can continue to serve Delawareans.
Are arts organizations statewide, Jessica, coming back from the pandemic? And if not, what do they need to get back?
They really are coming back. Most organizations, as you know, Kelly, pivoted during the pandemic and were offering either hybrid virtual programming or a lot of organizations moved to outdoor programming and just generally came up with creative new ways to deliver the arts. So I would say after the initial shutdown, the sector did do a good job of adapting. And now that we're able to gather again in large groups, certainly arts organizations are resuming some of their more traditional programming, you know, the stuff that that folks know and love. But it's interesting to see how many arts organizations are actually keeping a lot of the new modes of delivery that they've invented during the pandemic. In fact, Opera Delaware is about to launch their mobile stage to be able to bring opera performances throughout the state. Many organizations have gone mobile with their productions, and it doesn't look like that's going to stop anytime soon. And the other thing that organizations learned is that people do enjoy outdoor performances, and we're seeing more and more of that. And we're also seeing a continuation of hybrid programming. So people will continue to have the option to enjoy the arts from the comfort of their homes or from far, far away, wherever they may be, as long as they have an internet connection. So we're seeing some of these things are going to stick around.
Yeah, I was going to say, I talked to a lot of these organizations, and a lot of them, like you just said, pivoted to outdoors or a hybrid mode of operation during the pandemic. And they're continuing that because they found that it works for people who partake in these organizations and they enjoy being outside.
That's right. It was interesting to see a lot of these organizations open up or get to know new audiences, new members, because they were sort of outside of the traditional venues that they perform in. I think they got exposure to larger audiences, and more people became interested in what was going on because it was out there in the open to see. And more people who, you know, don't feel comfortable leaving their homes can join virtually. So I think it's a really interesting thing that happened during the pandemic, where arts organizations found themselves welcoming in new audience members that they hadn't ever reached before.
Absolutely. Hey, look, I was looking at the release, and it says grant updates for fiscal year 2023. And that includes, and I want you to explain, because this is returning, transportation, yeah. Not transportation, but transportation.
Yeah.
What
yes.
is this about?
Emphasizing the art. We made up a word. We just kind of combined transportation and art for our transportation grants. It's a grant that has been on hold for the last couple of years due to COVID, but it's really meant to support travel expenses, including buses, fuel, parking tolls, anything related to travel for school children to travel to Delaware arts and cultural institutions and to attend arts performances throughout the state. So it's up this year. We, because of the rising costs in fuel and really everything, we have upped this grant to $500 in hopes that that will, subsidize some great field trips to some great venues. And we're excited that it's returned this year and that arts organizations are really excited to start welcoming school field trips back.
And artist opportunity grants have increased to $1,000. Talk about that.
They have, Kelly. Artists were particularly hard hit during the pandemic. Many of them lost opportunities to exhibit and to sell due to cancellations. And as we know, the price of everything, including art materials and supplies, are going up dramatically. So we decided this year, in order to help those individual artists, to increase that opportunity grant from $750 each to $1,000 each.
Jessica, as the director of the Delaware Division of the Arts, moving forward, what is your hope for arts organizations statewide?
My hope is that arts organizations really continue to explore this idea of increased access and increased engagement with audiences. I think that there's an opportunity to build on the momentum that started as a positive outcome of the pandemic, which is this opportunity to think creatively about delivering the arts. So I think more and more organizations are going to be working with communities, with existing audiences, and with potential new audiences to make sure that they're tapped in to what audiences want and need from our arts organization. So I'm excited to see how that continues to develop. We're really grateful to be able to grant this money out to this community. The arts and culture community does amazing things with these funds. They make them go a long way, and we're just glad that they're able to serve Delawareans throughout the state.
Thanks to Delaware Division of the Arts Director Jessica Ball and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and the latest historic preservation story from contributor Larry Nightengast. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We close out this week's show with contributor Larry Nightengast and his ongoing examination of historic preservation efforts and issues in Newcastle County. This week, Larry's coverage takes us to a property in the city of Newcastle. Buttonwood is a 180-year-old riverfront summer home associated with a 19th-century Delaware Supreme Court Chief Justice. But it has fallen into disrepair and faces several obstacles to avoiding demolition by neglect. For this week's Enlighten Me, Larry details these obstacles in his latest piece available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to assess its future. So as we always do with these historic properties we talk about, let's start with the history lesson. Tell us a little bit about Buttonwood. You note in your piece, it may not stand out as much as other sites we've discussed, correct?
Yeah, you're right about that. You know, when we talk about historic Newcastle, when anybody talks about historic Newcastle, you know, some of the first buildings that come to mind are, of course, the courthouse and the sheriff's house and the George Reed II house, the arsenal, the Amstel house, the Dutch house. Buttonwood seldom gets any sort of mention. And, you know, partly that's because it's been vacant for more than 25 years. And also because it's really off the beaten path. It's actually in an industrial park just north of the Newcastle's historic district. Anyway, talk about the history a little bit. Although the Buttonwood property is also often associated with James Booth Sr., who was the former Chief Justice of Delaware, the home itself was built in the 1830s, which was actually a few years after James Booth Sr. died. And it was apparently built by the brother-in-law of one of his daughters. And now, as was the custom of affluent Newcastle residents of the era, Buttonwood served as kind of a vacation getaway. It was a riverfront haven that they used to escape the hustle and bustle of downtown Newcastle, if you can imagine that. And even if it was really just a mile away from the heart of town, the home and the adjacent farm stayed in the hands of the Rogers family. Those were Booth's in-laws until 1879, when it was sold at a sheriff's sale because the Rogers family had a bunch of unpaid bills. Later on, there was a succession of steel mills owned the property, and they typically rented the land to tenant farmers. So Buttonwood itself remained intact. It was never torn down or actually became part of any of the steel mill operations. Then in the 1990s, the River Edge Business Park was developed, and Buttonwood stood on the southeastern corner of the business park. And to make room for a warehouse that was being built, the builder moved Buttonwood, moved the house about 300 feet. So it's a little bit closer to downtown and a little bit closer to the river than it was originally. Now, no one has lived in the house since then. And, you know, while the interior is said to be in relatively good shape, right now it certainly needs a new roof and some other repairs to keep the deterioration from accelerating.
And you note in your piece there are some other reasons beyond it's maybe not so big history that do make it worth But Larry, you do note there are some other reasons beyond this building's historical significance that do make it worth saving. What are those other reasons that make this building stand out?
Well, broadly speaking, a 1996 University of Delaware study called the Buttonwood a significant example of the type of rural dwelling that was associated with Newcastle residents who had both urban and rural residences. And you mentioned, you know, this is the summer home. They had, the Booth family had two houses, one for the 9 months of the year and then one for the summer. Now, more specifically, the design shows that the house was probably used largely for entertainment purposes. On the main floor, on either side of a hallway that stretches all the way from the front to the back of the building, are two large parlors, and there are double-edged leaf doors in between each of the parlors. So it's kind of easy to envision a large party. This was sort of a 19th century version of an open floor plan. So you could move very easily from one parlor to the other on the left side of the stairway and the hall, and the other two parlors on the right side, or across from one to the other. So you have four very large rooms, all suitable for entertaining on the main floor. Then on top of that, there's a lot of Greek Revival trim, marble fireplace surrounds, and a lot of the interior hardware, I'm told, actually remains there as well.
So what's the current state of Buttonwood? Is it as far gone as some of the other sites that you've looked at recently?
Well, you know, I've seen numerous examples of demolition by neglect around Newcastle County, and Buttonwood isn't one of them, at least not at this point. Now, I haven't been inside Buttonwood, but those who have, and people have been inside it as recently as early June, they say that the interior is in pretty good shape. And yet they warn that if the roof isn't repaired or replaced fairly soon, water intrusion could do major damage to the interior. Now, besides the roof, some of the exterior brickwork needs repair, and new stairways are going to have to be built both front and back in order to have easy access to the building. And in all probability, if any sort of restoration occurs, they're going to have to build a large porch running the length of the back of the house to recreate how it looked in the 19th century.
So your piece notes several obstacles to saving Buttonwood. One of them is location. You've talked a little bit about this already, but can you go a little bit deeper and tell us why this is a problem?
Well, as I said, it's in the corner of this business park, and this warehouse is about a football field away on one side. On the other side of the house, there are wetlands. Now, if you lived in Newcastle 150 years ago, it would have been pretty easy to get to Buttonwood from the downtown area. It would be a kind of a direct route. But with that industrial park, that's certainly not the case today.
And you also seem like you're suggesting there's an accessibility problem here. Tell us a bit more about this accessibility issue and what issues it raises.
Well, you know, again, once upon a time, before the industrial park was built, there was a road that would have led from Route 9, Newcastle Avenue, pretty much straight back to where the Buttonwood Mansion is located. But now, if you've got a car or a truck, the only way to reach the building is through the industrial park. And that means the entrance is probably a mile or so away, down by the entrance to the Delaware Memorial Bridge, where Route 9 and the entrance to the bridge intersect. So you've got a very long drive, really, to get through that way. Now, if you're coming from downtown Newcastle, well, you can't do that directly either, because the logical direct route would be to walk along the Delaware Riverfront. But there's another industrial park closer to the historic district, and you would have to get an easement to get permission to build and construct a path to run along the riverfront through that industrial park to get over to where Buttonwood is.
And finally, there's a question about ownership. What do we know about that?
Well, again, Buttonwood takes up a small portion on the edge of this larger parcel that includes the piece that has the warehouse on it. Now, since the 1990s, this larger parcel has had several owners. The original owners back in the late 1990s had some interest in preserving Buttonwood. But since then, the ownership has changed a couple of times. The current owner is a fairly large real estate investment trust based in Boston that owns no other properties at all in Delaware. So, you know, in terms of profitability, there's little incentive for that owner to maintain or improve Buttonwood. And hence, there's this possibility of the house falling victim to demolition by neglect. And, you know, for those who would like to preserve the building, the consensus seems to be that they're going to have to find a way to put this building in the hands of a nonprofit organization or a government agency that would be willing to take on the restoration and the maintenance of the property.
So what are the best options for saving Buttonwood? What would a plan for its future look like?
Well, there's no plan yet, and that's part of the concern here. You really need a plan before you can go out and look for funding to make the restoration work. Now, first of all, there are, however, plenty of ideas. It probably wouldn't include, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, which would be an old house museum. And you know, those are just not as popular now as they might have been a generation or so ago. The location, as I said, through this business park, isn't the type of thing that's going to encourage vehicle traffic to get to it. However, given the history of the building, some people say it could work as a venue for social events. Or it could possibly be transformed into an office for, say, an architectural or an engineering business that cares about history or the environment. Or maybe it could be an office for a nonprofit, again, an organization that might be interested in history or an ecology. Another possibility that someone mentioned was this the concept of the resident curatorship, where you might have somebody who's steeped in history living in one portion of the building and maintaining it opening up the other portions, the non-living areas, for various types of public events. So there are a lot of possibilities, things that people are thinking about, but nothing that you might consider a plan, at least not at this point.
And of course, any plan requires money and people or groups working on the property's behalf. Is there any sense that these things can come together for Buttonwood?
Well, let's just say that there's hope. The driving force right now for restoring the old house is Paul Campanelli, a guy whose Newcastle roots include having a father and a grandfather who both served on Newcastle City Council as the city's police commissioners. And now Mr. Campanelli is pulling together folks from a variety of different interest groups, from the Newcastle City Government, the trustees of the Newcastle Common, the Newcastle Historical Society, Preservation Delaware, University of Delaware Center for Historic Architecture and Design, and a number of other organizations. And he's trying to connect with the influential people who can help him tap into possible government or foundation grants to make this work. You know, the key here, as I indicated, is that they first got to figure out a viable adaptive reuse for the building and then use that vision as the centerpiece for their fundraising campaign. Now they're very much in the early stages right now, and you know, it's more likely that this process is going to turn out to be a marathon rather than a sprint. However, no matter how long it's going to take, there is a significant need to put some money into Buttonwood fairly soon, because if there's too much water leaking through that roof, it could very easily wash all of these visions away.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingast for enlightening us this week. His piece on the fate of the historic Buttonwood property in Newcastle is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, the NPR One app, and the Delaware Public Media app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes from Dana, the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Nonprofits help improve our lives, and Dana helps improve nonprofits. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast. Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari and Kelly Steele. And our show producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.